I lost the me that felt I lived in peacetime, because now I felt emotionally I was caught up in the conflict. It was now my conflict, because we're connected through him planting that bomb that killed my dad. So that's like a huge wound that connects us. And then that's when he stopped talking and he said to me, Joe, I don't know who I am anymore. Can I hear your pain and your anger, and what can I do for you? And I knew in that moment he'd taken off his political hat and he started his own journey in the community. But now he's seeing that he was also demonizing the other, and that he couldn't have set that bomb off if he saw everyone in the hotel as human beings. I mean, I just don't think we can do that. We have to demonize people before we can hurt them.
Thank you very much for sitting down and joining with me, Joe. I appreciate it. You've got quite a story to tell. Would you mind going back to the beginning with me? What was it like? I guess what was your growing up like, and what was it like having like a fairly high level politician as a father?
That is going back a long time. So I grew up with my father as a politician, and I quite often see him in the House of Commons, because he'd be working so hard. I would go there to meet him for evening meal or for lunch. And I remember as a child going with him to where he was MP in North London, and everyone would want to speak to him and ask him questions. And he would take a lot of time to speak to you. I just remember him being he was very caring. And back in the 70s, 80s, like, they were free just to walk around, you know, there was no security. It was just like, we go, and he'd open like a bazaar or a fete, and he'd just be walking around saying hello to everyone. And I think as a child it was a bit boring. I do remember, like, at times realizing that he had the kind of job, which meant there were certain sort of privileges that came with the job, but also to me, you know, he was just my dad. And I did grow up being aware of the conflict in Northern Ireland, and there were some bombs going off in London. I remember, like, I couldn't get to school, you know, because the roads were shut. And but I lived in peacetime, you know. I never thought my dad would be at risk of being targeted by the IRA. To me, the conflict was something that happened over there, you know, and it wasn't something that impacted me. And I have many friends now who had to check their cars every day in the morning to see there was no bomb there. That wasn't me, you know. I just felt completely immune to it all and living on my own bubble, which was peacetime.
What year were you born? I'm sorry,
I was born in 57, so I'm 65. So my dad was killed in 1984 when I was 27.
Okay, I was going to ask, because I suppose the IRA campaign of bombing, which to be fair, usually didn't end up in lives being lost or injury, but sometimes that was taking place through like the 70s and 80s. So yeah. It's not like you would have been a child and not noticed that kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, there were people killed in London and injured and during that time. But it was unusual, you know, and I just thought that it wouldn't happen to me. I wasn't going to be affected by the IRA. It wasn't something that I was concerned about. And, you know, I know people who as children were really concerned about their families, but, you know, I felt completely safe. So when the bomb went off on the 12th of October, 1984, my father was attending the Conservative Party conference. I was, you know, shocked. Shocked is an understatement. You know, I was traumatized. I just couldn't believe that someone would target the Conservative Party and my dad. And we waited 8 hours, maybe 10 hours, and then we heard that his body had been found. And I didn't just lose my dad in that bomb, who I was really close to him. We had a fantastic relationship. But I lost the me that felt I lived in peacetime, because now I felt emotionally I was caught up in the conflict. It was now my conflict. And my heart understood a little bit about the pain of a violent conflict, whatever we call it, the troubles, it doesn't matter to me. The pain is the pain. And it connected me to the people in Northern Ireland and others who've been through it. And I couldn't go back to the person I was, because now I was understanding what it meant. And it is different to me, the wounds of terrorism, the wounds of war, to losing someone through a car accident, which is still awful, but it's how it happened was really important to me. So 2 days later, I made a decision to understand those who'd killed my dad and bring something positive out of it. I didn't want to have an enemy, but that day I did, and I wanted to find a way to heal that and to bring some meaning. I didn't want to go for revenge. I didn't want to blame anyone, but I wanted to find a way to bring something peaceful out of it. But I did not have the how. I was like, how do I do this? I had no idea how.
What were you doing in your life at
At that time.
at the age of your mid-20s when your father was tragically killed?
So I had a ticket, an air ticket, for 2 days later. I was going to go to Kenya, and I was off on an adventure, and I'd done a whole lot of different things, and I didn't feel ready to settle down, so I was off to have a different experience of traveling in Africa. That was my dream, was to go there. And I'd said goodbye to my dad. He knew I was going, and said goodbye to him before he went to Brighton. And of course, I never went. I mean, it was like, how can someone just travel and ex have a life like that when this is this is the real world, and this world is very different.
Did you sorry, at the time, due to the IRA activity and the bombs and so on, was there any kind of mistrust of like Irish people generally? Would you have known many?
Oh, not me. No. I mean, I was one for the we are the human family, and I had a little bit of a hippiness about me. So of the we are one family, and like peace and love. Like, I was at the tail end of the 60s and was very carried away by the whole thinking at that time and influenced by it. And so I was never one to mistrust people at all. In fact, my whole attitude was just to trust the world. I was sort of, in some ways, very, very naive.
Had your father experienced any kind of bomb scares before? Were there any occasions where, like, if security measures hadn't been taken, then possibly he may have come across with one of the bombs that had been laid
I
previously?
think so. He did lose a friend to the IRA, but I think that was the first time that the government were targeted, as far as I know. But yeah.
I see. I see. Okay. So, can you take me? It must be a sort of tough thing to do. But can you take me back to maybe like the actual moment when you realized a bomb had gone off, and that your father had been potentially in its path?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was obviously very shocked and upset, and the nightmare of waiting, which is, I know people have had to wait for news from other terrorist attacks, and it's just the worst thing, because waiting, and kind of the more I was waiting, the less hope there was. My stepmother was with him at the time. She was injured, and my brother found her in hospital. Yeah, it's just like being catapulted into another reality where there's no connection to the me before the bomb, because it's just a world of the worst thing has happened and just waiting, and like, can't believe it, but it's true. And then when we got the news that he'd been killed, me and my sister had to go and tell my little brother and sister, who were still at school, take them out of school, tell them their dad was dead and their mum was injured. That's because they're from my mum, my dad's second marriage. And then take them to their aunts, you know, and to know that I'm gonna be talking to these two little people, to give them the worst news possible is, you know, horrible. I mean, looking back on it, like, we should have had someone with us, you know, family liaison, but there was nothing. There was nothing there. There was no support. There was no one there to help. We were completely on our own and had to just deal with it all as a family.
Did you find out initially on the news?
No, no, phone call. Phone call from my brother. My brother found out because he was living in Brighton. So he, I don't know how we would have found out if it hadn't been for him. He was actually looking for my father and asking people, had, you know, had they seen him? And then he was there when they found a body and he identified. And he was only 24.
Jesus, okay, yeah, tough. I mean, I don't. There's a good age to lose a parent,
No.
but yeah, in your 20s, it'd be tough. Okay, so you got the phone call. You then found out hours later that he had passed. Was it some people describe like a kind of a numbness or a shock, upon hearing such news. Was that the case with you?
Yeah, well, I described it as the biggest shock possible. So shock, yeah. I mean, it's hard to put words to it, but it was, yeah, a complete shock.
Okay, so you went and identified the body. You had to tell your younger siblings. What was the next? You did say that within 2 days you would kind of come to the realization that you wanted, you weren't after revenge or anything. Yeah, can you describe like those 2 days? That's a very quick turnaround. I to be honest, when I was thinking of questions, I was imagining that you would say it took months or years to come to a place where you wanted to reconcile and forgive instead of revenge, you know?
I think it came quickly because of the person I already was, you know, and I couldn't go back to that person. For the reasons I've already shared, you know, that now I feel like I'm part of a war. And so it was who am I now? Do I give up on the world that I believe in? Or do I find a way to integrate this in a new way? Do I find a way to transform it? And that was the decision. But as I said, I didn't have the how. But I think if I hadn't made that decision, then I would have been really lost. So even though I didn't know the how, it gave me a sense of purpose and meaning and something that would somehow take me through the like darkness of the whole experience.
Okay, so you mentioned that after about 2 days you'd come to a place in your mind where you weren't after revenge, and it wasn't quite anger, but you wanted like understanding and forgiveness. How soon was it that you had your first communication with the man who had transpired had planted the bomb, Patrick McGee?
Well, that's jumping quite a few years. So that's after the peace process. So he came out of prison in 99. So he was arrested in 86. And I did actually travel to Belfast in 85 and 86 and met many people who helped me to understand and gave my first talk actually in 85 in Belfast. And so I felt that I was involved, you know, I was doing something. There was lots of synchronicities and meeting extraordinary people. So I found going there, I was welcomed with so much warmth and people really appreciated what I had to say. But it was only in the peace process that things changed a lot because we had peace. And part of the peace process was that the political prisoners came out early from prison. And so Patrick McGee came out in June 99. And I remember turning on the TV and there he is coming out of prison, right, as a free man. And we weren't prepared, we weren't told this was going to happen. So it was a shock. You know, it was a shock because I didn't know. And my first thought was, this isn't okay. You know, he's free. And my dad can't come back. How is this justice? Like, I felt angry that he was free. But then I thought, but this is for the bigger picture. This means that less people are going to be killed, and therefore, you know, I welcome the peace process for sure. And then the thought came to me, well, maybe I can meet him now he's out. And it was a thought that sort of came and went. Then soon after that, I was invited to the first victims group in Ireland of people who'd been affected in England. Because if we lived in England and you're affected by the IRA, you know, everyone lived all over the place. Like I didn't meet anyone else apart from my family till 99 who'd lost someone to the IRA. So it wasn't like we were a group or a community. So this was the first time that I was invited to a residential program for people who'd been affected. And I remember walking into the room and knowing that I was safe there, that no one would say to me, surely, Joe, you've let go by now. Like they'd understand my pain, they wouldn't be scared of it, and they'd want to hear about it. And it was a very transformational time meeting other people. And later that year, this is year 2000, I met some people who'd been in the IRA. It was at a weekend. And they, I asked them lots of questions, and they were very open to listening to me and giving me answers. And I said to one of them, because they all knew Pat McGee, I said, you know, do you think you could arrange for me to meet him? And they were like, yeah, no, for sure. And during that year, I met other people as well. And I kept on saying, you know, if you want to, if could you introduce me to him? I want to meet him. And I kept on getting messages back of people saying, oh, so sorry, but doesn't want to meet you, Joe. And what I haven't talked about is the whole journey's been about trusting, you know, trusting that I'll meet the right people, the right things will happen, that I don't need to force it. And so I was thinking to myself, well, maybe it's not going to happen. Maybe it's this, because I had the idea of building a bridge with him. Maybe this building a bridge with him is too difficult. And so I let it go. And actually, there were other bridges to build. I mean, I was meeting other people who were involved and getting close to some families from Bloody Sunday, other atrocities that had happened. So I was immersing myself in the kind of post-peace process time, which was actually quite an exciting time. You know, a lot of people were coming together and there was a lot of hope, and I was part of that. So I kind of thought, well, it's not going to happen. And then a fourth person said, I'd written a poem for Pat called Bridges Can Be Built. And I shared this poem at a peace conference in Dunleary. And someone there said, I can introduce you to Pat. And as always, I said, please do. And this time it worked. You know, he actually did organize it. And I remember it was in November 2000. I got a message from a friend of mine in Dublin to say that she'd met with Pat the night before, and he could come to her house at 7 o'clock that night if I could come. And I was on my way to Glencree Reconciliation Centre in the Wicklow Mountains anyway, so you know I was going to be in Dublin. But my first thought was, oh, not today, please, I can't do this. I'm not feeling courageous enough. I'm not, you know, I'm just thinking about my daughters I'm leaving behind, and I can't do it. And then I thought, how would it feel to be meeting the man who's killed my father? Like, that's such a huge thing. And, you know, so I might as well say yes. So I said yes. And, you know, I now do facilitate restorative processes and justice. And like, this broke all the rules. You know, I was there on my own traveling, like, no preparation, no one there to facilitate, just left with my own thoughts of, what's it going to be like? You know, I knew that I was meeting him in order to hear his story and see him as a human being. I wasn't expecting him to say sorry, or I'd learned a lot from meeting other people in the IRA, and I knew that he was going to come with a sense of political righteousness, and that was fine. I knew I was safe. I knew that he was committed to the peace process because not everyone was, but I knew that he was, I wasn't physically going to be hurt. So that was sort of my preparation. But I was absolutely terrified, yeah, happy to share what happened if you'd like.
Of course. I mean that initial, geez, did you remember what it was like? Just that initial moment where you both looked into each other's eyes and said love
Yeah.
for the first time. God, what was that like?
You know, I had some silly thoughts looking back. I was like, oh, you don't look like my idea of a terrorist, which it's like, what is our idea of a terrorist? But yeah, and then I'd have a thought of what am I doing here? We were sitting on a sofa in a room at the back of the house, just him and I. And I was like, what am I doing here? Sitting with a man who's killed my father. I should go now. Go, I should go. This is betraying my father. And then yeah, not quite believing it. But then more of me, and this is why I stayed, was really curious. I'm here. I'm building a bridge with him. And what's going on beneath the surface? So he started off by giving me the political reasons why he joined the IRA. And it was all very removed and detached. And he used the word we a lot. It wasn't like I, it was we. It was, he was speaking for his community. But I do remember at one point looking into his eyes and seeing that he was really motivated by caring for his community. Because he shared, and I did know some of this before, he shared the suffering he'd seen happen to his people and how he'd thought long and hard about what to do to support his people. And then he decided to join the IRA. It wasn't a quick decision for him. It was something he thought about. But when he was talking about some of the suffering he'd seen and that people were under siege, I saw that caring in his eyes, and he was at that time the most demonized ex-terrorist we had. Things have changed since then. But at that time in 2000, well, we were about to have 9/11, but we hadn't had 9/11. Yeah, so he was just the way the Daily Mail spoke about him, was just using dreadful, dreadful demonization words, which I never wanted to believe in because I don't believe anyone is evil. We've all got our stories. So I remember looking into his eyes and seeing that caring. And then at that moment, he is a real human being. But he was justifying killing my father. And for him, it was my dad was a legitimate target. It was a means to an end. And for him, it was successful. Well, I mean, the bomb was not successful for me. I was still healing as I am now. I mean, I don't think we ever get over something like that. It changes, but the wound is always there in some form. So I thought, well, I'm going to end this now because I've got what I want. He's no longer an enemy, a demonized enemy. He's now a real human being. So I'm going to go. And then that's when he stopped talking and he said to me, Joe, I don't know who I am anymore. Can I hear your pain and your anger and what can I do for you? And I knew in that moment he'd taken off his political hat and he started his own journey. And so I stayed because I knew it was going to be a very different kind of conversation. So it was also actually really scary. It was like, oh my goodness, this is more than I bargained for. I was about to go and now I'm going to stay. And so after that, he stopped using the word we. It was more like I. And he asked lots of questions about my dad and he talked about the impact on me. He wanted to know how I'd been impacted. And gradually he moved from seeing my dad just as a name, a label, a cipher, to now seeing my dad as a human being with a soul. And for him to make that change, it meant he had to change. Now, I didn't meet him to change him. I met him to heal something deep inside myself. But now he's changing because he's choosing to change. And he's saying that he's guilty of something that he would accuse the others of, which is like he was demonized. And yeah, it's true. he was demonized, his whole group was demonized, but now he's his whole community, but now he's seeing that he was also demonizing the other, and that he couldn't have set that bomb off if he saw everyone in the hotel as human beings. I mean, I just don't think we can do that. We have to demonize people before we can hurt them. And so, but now he's rehumanizing my dad and seeing him as a real human being. And so that was very powerful, very, very powerful conversation.
In that first meeting, did he open with an apology? I think a lot of people would, really.
And I didn't want it, because it wouldn't have been real. But he ended after 3 hours. I couldn't listen anymore, you know, and this is about the listening podcast, good listeners. For me, listening is a big part of it. I listened to him, but I'd run out of being able to listen to him. And so I ended it. And that's when he said to me, "I'm really sorry I killed your dad." And it did mean something to me. And it wouldn't have meant anything to me at the beginning, but it did at the end, because now he's actually recognizing that my dad is a human being.
When again during that initial 3 hour meeting, that's three hours a long time to talk to somebody.
Yeah.
Did you get the sense initially or during the conversation that he was like nervous about meeting you or feeling guilty? Did he feel comfortable meeting you?
I think because I've just been with him in Switzerland, and he talked about how he felt uncomfortable as soon as he got to the door. And I mean, yeah, I wasn't picking up it at the time, but he later said that he was trying to imagine what would happen if the situation was reversed. How would he feel? You know, and he didn't think he could even do it. And so he was trying to empathize with me and beforehand.
Okay, so you have that initial meeting, you speak for 3 hours. That's I can only imagine the kind of roller coaster of emotions during that.
Yeah.
When you then left that meeting, was there any desire to meet up again? To talk that there was.
Yeah, I mean we didn't plan it then, but I think for both of us, we'd started something that wasn't finished, and he would say that he didn't feel he could be the one to make the move. You know, he would have to wait for me, which I think is appropriate. But I mean, I'd started something huge and it wasn't finished. You know, little did I know that 23 years later, I would still have that feeling it's not finished. You know, I mean, that is the, looking back on the whole thing, it's incredible. I mean, I think just what I didn't know, if I had known, someone said to me, "Joe, this is going to be the start of a dialogue for 23 years. It's going to take you to your limits and back, and it's going to be transformational and sometimes amazing, sometimes hard, and challenge you on the deepest level." I probably would have said, "You know what? No." But I didn't know that.
When was the next time you communicated or met in person?
About 2 weeks. 2 weeks later.
And it was another in person meeting.
Yeah, and actually that one was some of it was filmed. So the girl whose house it was, Anne Gallagher, sadly she's died. She's got her own story of the troubles, and amazing, amazing woman. She had her own reconciliation project in Belfast called Seeds of Hope. And she decided to get a friend of hers to come and film it purely for her reconciliation project. Like, I was never going public, you know, never. If you said to me, like, "Are you going to tell anyone?" I was like, "No way. This is just for me." It's personal response. So this guy, Michael Afton, came down from Belfast with a little camera. And then when he started filming it, he was amazed. You know, he was completely like, he just couldn't believe what he was saying, because he knew that this was something different that hadn't happened before. And so after that second meeting, he got in touch with both of us and said he'd like to find a way to carry on filming for a documentary, but it wouldn't be for a long time and we didn't need to agree. But he just wanted to get some footage in. And actually, if he hadn't done that, then we probably wouldn't have had the means to meet each other, because I had no money to travel at that time, and nor did he. And the actual filming became the way we carried on continuing our dialogue for that first year.
Did you sorry, I guess this would be more for the initial meeting, but did you have any like particular questions for him that stayed on your mind in the years between the bomb and meeting him?
I'm sure I did. I think that one of the questions that I'm still grappling with, and so there was a time when I did feel some rage, and the rage when it came was how can your need to be heard is so important you took my father's life. And I think that's what we go back to sometimes, like how come you feel you're so right you can kill for that cause. And that's something that I'm still trying to understand. I mean, I am understanding it because I can see that I can sometimes feel so right about something that I don't care about other people. You know, I'm just wanting to tell people what I think. I can get that, but of course that's on one end of a spectrum. But I felt that in me, and I can also understand his what happened to him for him to feel it was the only way. You know, I can understand that. But that's a question that does come back, you know, how can you feel so right? And it's, you know, it's hard to understand, but I think that's part of us as human beings, is that we have that potential when other choices are taken away. You know, like if he'd had other choices, he would have taken them. And to me, that's a shared responsibility, you know, like if we had a different kind of politics. And one of the first things Pat said when we gave our first talk was that he now knows he could have sat down and had a cup of tea with my dad. He now knows stuff about my dad to know that. Now, I can see the two of them having that cup of tea, and that's actually very, very healing. But the Conservative government didn't and don't have policies of cups of tea, because what's to me a cup of tea is about dignity, respect, listening, dialogue, and it's a bit like building a bridge, you know, it's like a way of someone who we don't know, but wanting to meet them where they are and listen to their story. And that's not how we do politics. I mean, it's not just here, it's, you know, most places in the world, we don't do politics like that. It's not based on empathy, curiosity, and compassion, and understanding the needs of the other so we can form solutions. So, you know, I have understood a lot more of how we got that sense of I need to do this and I am so right in my cause and there's no other way. But that's obviously a hard question. And I think for Pat, he's been questioning himself ever since. What else could they have done? You know, what else could you've avoided it? And what we spoke last week in Switzerland to a group of people from around the world, that like over 75 countries are represented, and he shared a lot about the struggle for him, you know, what he's left with, like the cost to his own humanity, the pain that he feels, and like some people have accused me of being an easy choice for him. I actually think this is harder, because when he met me, he was fine, you know, he had no problems, like he was out of prison, he's free, you know, he doesn't have to think about his victims because they didn't. And now through knowing me, and we are friends, he cares about me, I care about him. So it means that he knows the impact of what he did, and he has to live with that. And he was asked about forgiveness, and he finds it hard. He won't forgive himself. That's for him, that's not what it's about.
Actually, I was just about to ask you on the theme of forgiveness. Did you ever get the sense that he wanted from you a forgiveness
No.
that I would do?
No, he's very, very clear. He wants nothing from me. You know, and that in a way makes it easier for us to carry on. Like I want nothing from him and he wants nothing from me. It's actually a very healthy kind of dialogue that and we both got choice all the time about whether to meet or speak. And I've taken breaks sometimes. And he's always very relieved when I get back in touch and say, okay, shall we do something here? Or And he's, you know, he's taken, especially when he's writing his book, he saw me a lot less. And but now we're actually planning to go to Kosovo together to speak, and he's agreed to do that. And when we were in Switzerland, there was a group from Lebanon. But it is definitely about choice. You know, he can choose to change or not, and I can choose to change or not. And that makes a very healthy foundation to our dialogue. And I actually don't really like to talk about forgiveness. You know, I find it a difficult word, and one that I don't feel is relevant, because to me, this is about understanding, and it's about empathy. It's about having empathy with someone who was an enemy, and now I understand his story. And I've had the same experience with someone from the Lawless community who was a combatant, the same with an ex-British soldier. I've empathized with all of them, and thinking, you know, I could have, if I'd lived your life, would I have made the same choices? You know, if I'd lived your, came from your community, I might have done the same thing. And that shows me that when we really hear people's stories, then there are no sides. And most of the time we take sides. We're like, we're the good ones, you're the bad, you know, like, and we align ourselves to one of them. And I don't want to do that, because I can empathize, and I call it unbounded empathy with all different sides. That doesn't mean I agree with their behavior, but it's about understanding their stories and where they come from, and moving from judgment to understanding, from blaming to finding a way to take responsibility from what I feel.
On the you touched on you touched on like friendship. You said that eventually you two were able to like form a friendship. How long? It might be a tough thing to measure, but how long from the first meeting did were you able to form a friendship? And did the was there anything like maybe on his part like a sense of guilt that might stop a friendship from forming? Because I know that if I felt very guilty about something I had done to you or a loved one, that would very much get in the way of me of us forming like a genuine friendship, because there would be like this underlying thing that I owe you something or I have a sense of guilt.
Yeah, that's a great question. I wish we could ask him. So I think that it is complicated, and our language has limitations to describe the nature of what I feel for him and what he feels for me. Because I do think that if I ask him to hear something, he'll put in more effort maybe than he might to other friends. Like, he takes our whatever this is, our relationship, really, really seriously because of what he did. And I, when I'm with him, I take it very seriously as well. It's kind of, we are really limited with words, because we're connected through him planting that bomb that killed my dad. So that's like a huge wound that connects us. And yet the trust has grown and grown and grown over the years. And generally, you know, when he saw me, he was really pleased to see me, and I was really pleased to see him. So is that, we call it friendship. And it did take me time to say that in the public arena. I think for the first few years, I would have felt I was maybe betraying my father by saying that. It took time. I don't know when it was I changed. But like, everything's been in stages, you know. Like, it going public was a huge thing to do. It was like really scary, really, really scary, because I loved my family. I didn't want to upset them, and I probably did at times. You know, I've just had to kind of find a way of making sense of it inside myself, you know, and listen to people who do find me difficult, because people do find me difficult. Like, I am a huge challenge for people because of what I've done.
Did it make any sort of difference to you or him that the weapon that did kill your father was like an indiscriminate one? It wasn't a case of someone walking up to him with a gun and shooting him. A bomb doesn't discriminate. Now he obviously placed it there to target mainly Margaret Thatcher, but members of her cabinet too. Did that come into it at all? The fact that it was like an indiscriminate weapon?
I haven't thought that. It's not, I haven't gone into that detail in my mind. Don't think I need to.
Did when speaking to Patrick, some, I mean, this is more, there's more people refer to to like the Nazis and the Nuremberg trial, but a common sentence was like, oh, I was just following orders. It wasn't like me an individual decision. It was my bosses telling me. Was there any degree of that with Patrick when
No,
this?
he always took complete responsibility, which I think made it easier for me. I mean, I have got a bit frustrated that he wasn't on his own. There were two other people, and I've always said, "Oh, can I meet them? I really want to meet them. Who are they?" And he won't talk about it. I think they could still be arrested if they were identified. And I've asked him about the details of planting the bomb, and he won't talk about any of that. That's just a no-go area. And there's been a book written about him recently and two plays written, and he just always says they haven't got it right. I'm like, okay. And I did actually, once I was walking past the Grand Hotel in Brighton, which is where the bomb was, and if you look at the hotel now, you wouldn't necessarily know. And we were being filmed for a document, another documentary, and as we're walking past the hotel, there's, at that point there's no camera on us, he's just speaking, he's like, yeah, that roof there, I remember sitting on that roof and looking at the building, and it was like, he said to me, oh, I'm actually remembering things I just don't think about anymore. And then he wouldn't talk anymore, you know, because I think he's probably doesn't want to think about that as well, but you know, he won't talk about that. And I, you know, I can get frustrated, but I course I respect it. And I've always said to him, if at any point one of the two other guys would like to meet me in private, you know, I would honor that, but it hasn't happened and it's fine. So
I see. Okay, so the way I discovered the way I discovered about you and Patrick was I
yes,
saw that
how?
you, yeah, it was like, okay, so I interviewed a gentleman who wrote a book quite recently about that bomb. It was called Killing Thatcher. So I initially found out, but and at the end they mentioned that and I it blew me away when I heard it, but I heard that the daughter of one of the people killed now has a like a relationship, a friendship with the bomber, and they go around doing speeches. Can you tell me about how like the speeches came about? Because it's one thing to meet and speak to each other, but then to go together and speak in front of a crowd about it. How did that come about? Was it your idea or his?
We were asked. Yeah, I don't think we had an idea. We were asked, and you know, the first time we were asked to speak was in London, and we only were given a few minutes each. And then I think what happened was, so we started sharing a little bit of our story, and the impact was incredible. People in the audience that were like, they got something from it that I couldn't have predicted. And so we got asked more and more, and I then founded a charity, and we've spoken over 300 times and in different places, in war zones, in prisons, in schools, in universities, in Northern Ireland quite a few times. Some things I've organized, like I've organized a trip to Palestine and Israel because I already had connections that were asking me, so I got funding for that, and sometimes we were invited. And I do a lot more than him and me, and I think that's really important. You know, I'm now a professional speaker, and I'm also a facilitator, and I do a lot of creating safe spaces for people to share, and I also teach skills about listening and conflict transformation, and I'm aligned with many different projects around the world, and this is my life, and I found a way. I've learned so much through dialoguing with him. And so much also with transforming what's happened to me into something positive, that I'm actually writing my book, but I'm using all that, because conflict's everywhere. You know, everyone experiences trauma and challenges, and so I've taken what I've learned to support and empower other people. But like, I was in Kosovo recently on my own before he's going to go with me next month in September. But for me to be with people who are experiencing the legacy of war and Kosovo, there's still a lot of pain there and it's still going on. It's not, you know, they haven't arrived at peace yet. It was so recent. And being able to, I use my story then, people feel trust. Like, I don't know how it happens. Like, people started opening up straight away and sharing. And I feel I've been given so many gifts by what I've been through. So I can, you know, I can now, I think back to the young me that wanted to make a difference. And, you know, I am making a difference. And yeah, it's grassroots and it's small and slow. But I'm really, to me, it's a privilege to be given the opportunities, whether I'm with him or whether I'm on my own.
I see. If you could, this might be hard to tell, but if 27-year-old you, saw what you're doing now and the relationship you have with Patrick McGee and speeches and so on, how do you think the 27-year-old Joe would view what you're doing now?
I think the 27-year-old me would be absolutely terrified. I didn't have great self-esteem back then. You know, and what I would tell the 27-year-old me, like that I would say, you know, the one thing you're going to need that you don't do right now is start taking care of yourself and giving yourself empathy and support. And I would let the 27-year-old know that she can be kind to herself and she's doing grand, you know, she's doing good. Because I had to learn that quite a hard way. And I'd tell the 27-year-old that you got this, you know, you will end up making a difference. So don't worry, don't panic, just take care of yourself, you know, and believe in you. But yeah, but the young me would be terrified, but I think also would maybe have a sense of everything will be okay, which I haven't always felt that.
Okay, so that level of like empathy and understanding that you described that you now have for Patrick after speaking for so long, do you think that if you had had that same kind of meeting and relationship but with someone who was way higher up in the IRA, who was like a decision maker, who, you know, he wasn't the guy who planted it, the guy who he would be the guy who decided to plant many bombs and commit many killings. Do you think if you sat down and spoke with someone like that as well, that you could come to the same conclusion, or is there like kind of levels to it, you know?
Person as an individual, you know, and I'm really willing to build bridges with anyone who would like to meet me. And there is someone quite high up who was quite high up in the IRA who we were about to meet. Sadly, he died. And but he, I think he would have, that would be a very powerful communication. So I'm certainly open to building bridges. Pat said that he was disarmed by my empathy. I wouldn't expect everyone to be disarmed by my empathy, you know, but I mean, this is also about having no expectations. So when I'm listening to someone and being like, I was really present to Pat, you know, I was really listening deeply to him. And that might have ended with him not changing, you know, and that would have been fine. It might have led to us only ever meeting once. But I would never have gone back for a second meeting if he was talking about justifying killing my father, because that wouldn't have been honoring myself. So I wouldn't have gone back and I would have still felt it was a successful meeting, you know. So these, like, I do a lot of restorative justice, and at the beginning we never know if it's going to end in a face-to-face because it might not always be appropriate, you know, and it might. So I have to manage their expectations, and I think I manage my expectations that, you know, it might never happen. Two, we might just meet once, and that's the thing with us, because we're dealing with emotions and feelings and layers of complexity of where people are at. You know, it's not always safe to bring people together, and it's not always appropriate to. And like, I can do my work with letters and shuttling and passing messages on. So I would have to, if I was going to meet someone who was high up in the IRA, I'd have to look at maybe just one meeting. You know, there's lots of things to take into account with, because we're all different and we're all in different stages of our journeys.
I very much appreciate all your time and everything you shared. It's quite it's quite like deep intimate stuff. I very much appreciate it. Is there any final, maybe like final message or final thoughts to leave listeners with?
I guess that we all go through difficult times, and there might be some of your listeners who are and you sometimes things happen and we have no choice. Like, I had no choice over what happened to me, but I had, and I have complete choice with how I respond. And I believe we have to take our power back. You know, sometimes when things happen to us, then events have power over us. We give them our power. They affect how we feel. And I think it's really important to say, I'm going to choose how I respond. I'm going to choose to find a way that actually won't take away the me and my life or my self-worth. And by taking our power back, we're giving up revenge, because revenge connects us to people in a very negative way. So if I'd carried on going for revenge, I would have had Patrick in my head as someone who'd hurt me. So by taking our power back, we're kind of liberated. And whatever's happened to anyone, by just saying, I'm going to start a journey, then we're starting a whole new way of looking at what's happened, and it'll involve healing and transformation. And yeah, it's hard emotional work, but it's worth it. You know, yes, my life has been hard in many ways, but now I can see and it's emotional work I've done has reached me in a place where I'm someone who wakes up in the morning feeling really good about myself, despite the fact that I still have challenges, because let's face it, life is really difficult.
Joe Berry, thank you very much again. All your time and everything you shared.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.